Bean, and welcome to another edition of Warrior Connection. You know, one thing that we learn, again, as we come into the Christmas season, respect is what we hope all veterans would get, but unfortunately, respect is not what the veterans get from the VA. I mean, day after day, we run into the problems. I ran into my problems again yesterday myself personally. I had a medical appointment with my primary care physician, and we've been trying to get into the Airborne Medical Registries exam program for forever and ever and ever, and got the rim around. We finally got the login for it. I logged in to get to start entering the data, and it came back that I was never in the Army, never deployed. God, you got to love what the VA does you on Christmas. I mean, it just never ends. What Ray and I thought we'd talk about today, and my role as a former preventive medicine officer with the 12th Preventive Medicine during Desert Storm as a combat medic, and Ray's work as a good old combat infantryman and a chaplain, we want to talk about the Christmas season. And how do we prepare, and what do we do, and what do we look for? Because no matter what you do, when you get around the holidays, and especially around Christmas, it runs into a problem. Personally, and Ray can tell you his story, I spent Christmas 1969, Christmas 1970, flying B-52s in and out of Utapau Air Force Base, Thailand, into North Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and South Vietnam, and southern China. And then back again, we went back in 1990, Christmas 1990. We were sitting at Alaskan Village, south of Riyadh, for Operation Desert Storm. So Christmas for me is very, very unique. And I had the opportunity to see the great legend, Bob Hope, three times. And for me, each time I see Bob Hope today, or we come to Silent Night, for anybody that's been there, at the end of Bob Hope's show, everybody's saying Silent Night. It's an emotional trip that's beyond comprehension. Well, Ray, how do we start, how do we begin to prepare everybody for what happens to the warrior on Christmas?
Well, you know, when you were talking, Doug, and about the VA and about other things and the Vietnam and all this Gulf War, the only word that kept coming to my mind was the word frustration. It is a time of, you know, happiness and family and all these type of things, but people spend a lot of money, and they're trying to buy things for people that sometimes they can't even afford to do it, but they're doing it because they feel like they have to or something. One thing our family has done is that all the adults in my family have made a pact, and we only spend $5 per person. We realized it wasn't our birthday, for one thing. And there's a lot more fun you can have when you – and you can make a through the big specials and all these things that are running around those times – and Black Friday, and all. You can buy some pretty good gifts for $5 if you really look hard. And so what it does, it takes a lot of pressure off of people. You know, we think of about a holiday for children, and it is. But, you know, it seems like the more you give, the more they want. And I think it's just a time to maybe back away and just get rid of some of the frustrations and kind of get your brain ready for what's coming. The parties and the people and the laughter and the noise and all these things that come with the holiday season. But, you know, being that we have been overseas and when you come back home, you're in a different world because when you go into a third world country, you begin to see in black and white life and death. And then when you come back home, you're back in the Disney world and everything is colorful and laughing and shiny and pretty. And we just don't fit in sometimes. And yeah, what we try to do is get the spouses to understand your spouse that has been overseas probably will have some problems with this, so don't push them too hard. Kind of walk them into it and maybe allow them to get out of it once in a while, get to themselves, and just prepare yourself, and, you know, ahead of time, and that way you won't be too shocked when it happens.
Yeah, it's real important. I mean, unfortunately, Captain David Boynette, another one has been on this radio program many, many times, and one of the nation's greatest veterans advocate, said some comments to me the other day and prepared for this thing. And because, as everybody knows, David is an incredible poet and a genius is the only way to describe him. And he put this, and it kind of sums it up together on everything we're looking at. And I want to read this, and then we'll have some discussion. We've got your papers of work you've been doing, Ray, we can discuss. Anyhow, David wrote in the title of this, Fighting in Hand-to-Hand Combat with Physical Pain. For years, I've been forced to live every second of every minute of every hour of every day and night in very debilitating chronic pain. It's the kind of pain that affects literally every functioning muscle in my body. It's unforgiving, unrelenting, and constant. After years of research and debate, it finally has a name. It's called Gulf War illness. And it is what and who I have become in more ways than I can count. Over the years, I've had a great deal of time to consider ways in which I might somehow find a way to overcome what is no doubt the most difficult and challenging problem I face in my lifetime. There always has been the final option. But to me, that's not the reasonable or rational option. That's the option chosen by those who have given up and given into this disease. I once was inclined to be a quitter, but thank God the United States Marine Corps taught me several decades ago that the last thing I am or ever will be is a quitter. That's an extremely ironic statement given the fact that the very reason I have this devastating illness is because of the fact that I was a Marine at the time of the 1991 Persian Gulf War. That is one and where this disease originated for me and many thousand other warriors who participated in that short, decisive war. So what's the answer? The answer is simple, and it's the only option left to me and to more than 200,000 American veterans of Operation Desert Storm who live as I do, day after painful day and night after painful night. The answer is fight on, fight with every fiber of your being. Fight to protect the things in your life that continue to make life worth fighting for. Fight to maintain your soul. Fight to hold on to those who, despite your physical shortcomings, continue to love and provide you with unconditional love and support, no matter the inconveniences and challenges that illness brings to their lives. Fight with the same tenacity that created the fighter that they brought out in you all those years ago during recruit training, officer candidate school, and countless leadership courses that you had the honor of participating in. Do you remember the most important part of what being a good leader involves? It's about leading by personal example. Lastly, always remember that victory is never out of reach. No matter how impossible odds may seem, especially on those days, worst days that we all know so well, victory in my brothers and sisters' arms is still achievable. Never allow yourself to believe otherwise. Victory is never choosing the weak man ways out. Victory is making sure your foe clearly understands that you're not going anywhere. If he wants that last of what remains in your backpack, your love, your soul, your dedication to victory, force him to come and take it from your lifeless, still, yet still warm fist. In the end, your opponent will understand it's not he who prevailed, it is you. You fought to the end with every tool at your disposal, and you never gave up. That, my fellow warriors, is how victory is defined. It's not about who dies first, it's about who lives. And it's about continuing to live every minute of every day, and who fights until there is no more fight left remaining in the foe. Never surrender, but most importantly, never stop living. Semper Fidelis, David K. Wynette, Jr., Captain, United States Marine Corps, retired.
That's awesome.
You know, David is busy today, or he would have joined us, but I had to read that because it goes to the soul of it, David. David went to the soul, didn't he?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, it does. I think it speaks for all of us, you know, when it says those things, too. That comes from a man that lives it. And, you know, I always say that the Marine Corps never taught us how to retreat. And part of what we do, well, we're here today because we didn't give up. But you can't give up. We cannot give up. And, you know, suicide is a very prominent thing this time of year, and it's terrible. And I wrote something, some articles in newspapers for a while. And one of the things I said, I know it sounds really hard when I say this to you, Doug, is that suicide is undoubtedly the most selfish thing you can do to those who you love and who love you the most. It slams the door shut in the face of everyone who cares about you and leaves them with a lifetime of wondering why you left without first reaching out to someone who could help you. And it's really that, and it's like they expected you to carry on. They expect you to never give up. Now, when you lose a friend like that, you lose a warrior. And David he's a true warrior. And I think that's what the warrior spirit is you never give up. I've studied Japanese Okinawan type of martial arts for 25 years, and the basis of that art is you never give up. The Japanese of World War II studied that art, and that was one of the reasons they were so hard to fight. It wasn't they were all black belts and stuff like that, but they studied the logic and the philosophies of you never give up, and it was a disgrace to give up. And though we're surrounded sometimes, and, you know, you're fighting your life to give other people Christmas more or less a party. And when we come home to it, it's almost like it's not our party. It's like we're kind of on the outside looking in. And they're saying, enjoy the party. Come on in, the noise and the fanfare and all this stuff going on. And there's something inside of us says, I can't do this. I can't take my eyes because I'm on watch. I'm on guard duty for my family. I'm on guard duty for my neighborhood. I'm on guard duty for my country. And so, therefore, you feel uncomfortable letting your guard down. And when you look at other people doing these things, it's obvious they don't. They're kind of in a la-la world, and they've let their guard down. And that's when the enemy really takes advantage of it. So I don't know if I'll ever let my guard down, Doug, or you either, because we've been there and we understand it. And these guys today will be doing the same thing.
You know, so many years ago, and again, we've talked about on this radio show before and it's been published, Christmas 1970, I was flying B-52 bombing missions to bomb Nab Hart at Aruda Pau Air Force Base in Thailand. On Christmas Eve in 1970, we had a mission plan, and we went to candlelight services and did all those things we have done since we were a child and continue to do in our old age, now with our grandkids and our families. And then we went on a combat mission.
Right.
And I'll never forget the feeling, the stuff where they said back home that there was a Christmas truce, and we knew there never was a truce. There was never a lull or a cessation in fighting. It continued day in and day out
right.
on Christmas. But when we had to go and bomb and killed, and even though we were in B-52s flying at 30,000 feet, the optics allowed us to see what was on the ground, and we knew what was on the ground from all the reports after we bombed because of the forward air controllers and the observers. And no matter who you are or what you're doing, even in the middle of a war or a battle, when you're involved in combat on Christmas, it goes so deep into the soul, into that moral being, which is now being finally recognized as a moral injury.
Right.
That something happens to you deeply, deeply down forever and ever. So when you come back on home on leave or for a few days, whether you're on active duty or you've been there and you're coming back and now you're sharing the time with your family, I mean, all of these things associated with the stress and the activities and the adrenaline rush and everything else, I mean, it can put you into a horrific turmoil at the same time that you're feeling and flying high as a kite. How do we prepare? I mean, obviously, you know, everybody wants to get there with their families, and then we get into our crowd. Well, all of us that have been there in some time or another, crowds don't do us real well, do they?
No. You know, I faked it for all these years. I would fake parties. I would fake noises and, you know, people laughing and music and Christmas stuff and everybody together. And I always felt phony by it because I felt like I was faking trying to be happy. I don't know why that is, Doug. Now, I have a lot of joy, but I don't, you know, I don't have a happiness like I see some people. They act like they don't even know what's going on or anything else. And I think once you've been on that guard duty, I don't know if you ever get off guard duty again. And the only thing you can do, you may be the only one in the room, the only one in the building, but you're on guard duty. And so you are not trying to make a scene. You're not trying to act a party pooper, but you're always on guard duty because you've been there and you know how quickly things change. And so you're going to be the one. You know, we're dealing with a lot of terrorism now, or at least the thoughts of terrorism. And when you go to places, when you go to company parties, when you go to different things, just like out in San Bernardino, there's always somebody on guard duty. Somebody has to be on guard duty. Now, I don't mean you have to be armed. If you are armed, that's good, or if you have license to do that, that's good. But even if you don't, you're constantly looking at things, looking at people, scanning the area, sitting with your back to the wall, and you're on guard duty. That doesn't mean you're not having fun. It just means you live differently. You look through different eyes than most people do. I think it's harder on the families because they look at you saying, well, Dad, lighten up. And you're like, I don't think so, you know, because I don't know if you can. And I think that's what Vietnam and Iraq and Afghanistan does to people. It changes us totally. When we come back home, Doug, we just don't fit in a lot of times. We have to make ourselves. My wife, she wants to go to everybody's funeral. I really hate going to funerals. I don't like funerals. because I think something died in me a long time ago when there was so much death going on. And I know everybody who's been there has probably experienced somewhat the same thing. And it's just something that I don't like to be reminded of. I don't like to go to them. I don't like to participate in them. But I do. I go sometimes to more closer family relatives and stuff. But it's not something that I choose to do. And I think it's because you never get off of guard duty. You're always, you've got your eyes open, your ears open, and you're watching and you're profiling or whatever you want to call it. But that's not a bad thing, not in the world we live in. It's an evil world, too. If more people were like that, we'd probably have a lot less terror or violence. You know, the terrorists, they go after people who aren't watching, who are very unsuspecting. And, you know, as long as there's veterans around, there's going to be people on guard duty. And if we drop out, Doug, there won't be anybody on guard duty. And well, so that's one reason we need to stay around.
The Army message that came out for the holidays was basically exactly what you just stated. I mean, keep a lower profile if you're traveling. I mean, traveling here in the States, everything is not so bad, but if you're overseas or traveling internationally, I mean, you don't want to be known as a member of the military or law enforcement. I mean, you and I have both been involved in law enforcement. You were a chaplain for the police for ever and ever and ever. And all that stuff comes into play, and so the stresses of the holiday come into play, and as David said, the incredible numbers, and we've got the new, brand-new epidemiological report that we just got that's only, I don't know, what is it, maybe 3 days old, maybe?
Right.
Something like that, and looking at all this stuff as we're going to go into. So you have all these physiological problems. We have all the neurological problems. We have all of the cardiac and respiratory problems. We have all the rashes. We have incredible levels of cancer. I mean, two members of my immediate group just been diagnosed with cancer in the last 2 weeks, as I've talked with you about. And so, I mean, it's a scary time. And so with all of that, and then we come on back of the PTSD or moral injury, I don't think it's any type of psychiatric injury at all. I think it's a deep moral injury, and I think it's a trauma that you lived about that the psychotropic drugs are not going to alleviate, they're not going to control or anything. But now we run into a problem, and I don't even know how to begin this, but we run into a problem around the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's, where everybody wants to go partying, or they go to a party, and whether they do or not, they're going to run into a situation where somebody wants to give them some booze, some alcohol, or some drugs to take and to enjoy that stuff. I mean, Ray, you've been working on this stuff, the misuse of alcohol and drugs, for so long among veterans. It's truly frightening, isn't it?
It is, and it's just so prevalent. And one of the problems is that the VA has put veterans on so much drugs, and I think it's probably about 90% of veterans are on some kind of medication if they're going to the VA. And if you add anything to those drugs, and just because you didn't take them a day doesn't mean they're in your system. They will stay around for a while. And so if you go and have a few drinks at a party, you've just accelerated all of that drug in your body, and you're going to probably fall asleep on the way home if you're not careful. And you may hurt yourself or somebody else in another car or somebody ride with you. You've been intoxicated. You say, well, I had two drinks. Well, you've had two drinks on top of everything else. And I remember in North Carolina, they were talking about a van out on Highway 95 traveling high rate of speed about 2 o'clock in the morning. Well, what they found, and it killed the entire family. But what they found out, a 16-year-old boy was allowed to drive about 2 o'clock in the morning. And apparently that boy was not used to staying awake. He was out there just enjoying his brand-new driver's license out on an interstate highway. And he fell asleep, and everybody woke up dead, you know, that kind of deal. You can't take chances, Doug. I mean, you know, like I say, we're always on guard duty, more or less. When people go to parties, you know, they leave your guns outside the room, and they you know, like in the military, you got to stand down, you put all your weapons away, and then you go in there, and you're partying, and you're drinking. Well, who's on guard duty? Who's watching the doors? Who's doing this? When you come back here, you know, you're back in this world, When people get together and do that, they don't want any kind of weapon. They don't want anything in that room. Why? Because people will do things when they're intoxicated that they wouldn't ordinarily do. People get mad. People get jealous. People get angry. And if you've got weapons, there's a possibility of bad things happen. So they want to disarm you. But when you disarm a whole bunch of people, you've got a lot of people that are very vulnerable. And so alcohol has a way of really debilitating people to the point that, you know, it's hard to say no. I know that I used to drink a lot. Nobody ever told me when to say when, or I've never had a bartender say, well, I'm not going to give you any more. And so you tend to always go further than what you planned on going. And, you know, if you try to drive home, you're going to find yourself in trouble.
Yeah, we got all this stuff. We got the medications they're taking. You got loss of fine motor control. You got the physiological manifestations affecting the neuromuscular system. You got all the stuff affecting sleep. I mean, no matter what you do, you're running into a risk. And then to back this all up, which is most frightening, I mean, this is maybe 3 or 4 days old. We got the post-deployment surveillance report. This is December 2015. Volume 1, number 1. And we just got this. I mean, I just got that, and I put it on to you. And the number one problem cited in the surveillance report is binge drinking.
Yeah.
Number one problem. This is separate from the physiological manifestations that come about. So, I mean, when we look at the report and just, I'm going to read this just a little bit. Binge drinking is estimated to account for more than 50% of annual alcohol-related deaths among U.S. adults. Numerous medical problems are associated with binge drinking, including external injuries, adverse birth outcomes, liver disease, hypertension, other health disorders. Existing research has reported comparatively high levels of alcohol disorders among veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan. Less is known about the lifetime prevalence or correlation of binge drinking among male National Guard and Reserve Veterans Operation During Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom. In a recent study, 9% of the sample of female National Guard and Reserve reported binge drinking in the past 4 weeks. We're looking at rates 30%. 30%. 30% of the population is binge drinking.
Well, before you can do that, you have to determine that you're going to be out of operation for a little while. Because when you begin to do this, you're going to be, if you don't pass out, you're going to be really intoxicated. You're going to be, you're not going to be able to function normal. But when you get ready to take a pint of liquor and put it to your mouth and hold it upside down until it's gone, and it will shoot right down your throat if that's what you want. And I know because I've seen people do this. I've never really done it myself. I always slowly got drunk, but they wanted to do it quick. It's a quick drunk. And they would take a pint of liquor and just hold it up and just shoot the whole thing down their throat. That was like a bong. That was like crack cocaine. It'd about take the top of your head off. But it was something people loved to do. They'd take a beer. Instead of drinking a beer, they'd hold it upside down and suck it down at one big swallow. Well, when it hits your stomach, then it gets to your brain, and you can't stop it. You can't reverse it once it starts doing that. If you've got a pint of liquor, you can imagine, Doug, one big gulp and it's down, and all of a sudden, you know, they were showing a guy on TV taking a pitcher of beer, and he could drop like 5 or 6 pitchers of beer a minute or something, just turn them upside down. Well, what does that do to your head? You're going to be incapacitated. You're going to be laying over in a corner, and anybody who wants to take advantage of you can do that too. And so if you're a young girl, there's bad things going to happen. I've known young girls to wake up in the morning and say, something's wrong. I don't feel right. I don't feel good. Come to find out all of her friends had taken advantage of her that night. And, you know, that's pretty demoralizing when that happened. You thought they were your friends. But that's what happens when you binge drink.
So again,
you say, well, I'll just do it at this party. I won't do it anymore. It doesn't work like that. These things become addictions real quick. It's a reprieve on life. You get off work, you've had a bad day, and so you dump 3 or 4 beers down your throat, and the first thing you know, you're asleep on the couch or passed out or throwing up on yourself, and your wife doesn't want to put up with that stuff.
I think what
it just turned out bad.
I think what you're talking about here is the key to the thing. What would define a PTSD or moral injury? But all these, I mean, incredible thousands upon thousands of individuals that are suffering this problem right now. I mean, it's absolutely staggering numbers. And so they're looking for a retreat. They're looking for a way out. Yeah, they're, as David said, don't give up the fight. But their life is a total mess with all of the stuff that's happening. And, you know, right there we're looking at this stuff, and this is combined incidents of this stuff with the PTSD and all this stuff is happening from Vietnam to Operation Desert Storm and Iraqi Freedom, everything, the whole thing. The numbers that the VA reporting with this stuff is 500,000.
The VA
way over. I mean, it's incredible numbers.
Yeah. Well, it is.
And this is just this that they're trying to escape from. This doesn't include the diagnosis for all the incredible medical problems that they have, which are up and above being wounded in action. I mean, when you're wounded in action, shot with a bullet or blown up with a bomb or something, that can be physiologically repaired. These illnesses and everything that are affecting your entire body, your entire system, are not visible, and yet the effects of them are far worse.
Well, and that's so, when you get into self-medication, what you're talking about, too, is that you're trying to medicate yourself to either not feel or to feel better about something. The problem is it always spirals out of control. And, you know, Doug, if you've got problems anyway, and you go to a Christmas party, and you binge drink, and you drive home, and you get stopped, you just blew $10,000 because that's going to be a DWI or something on that, and or DUI, DWI, whatever they call it. And so your life just went out of control. You may lose your license. You probably will. You may lose your employment because of what you do for a living. You may lose a security clearance because of it. It's just a lot of things, bad things happen if you allow yourself to do this kind of thing.
I mean, it's a conscious choice again. I mean, we preach this, and you've been preaching it. You and Johnny have been preaching this at Camp Lejeune forever and ever and ever and all over the place as we have. You have to make the choice of who you're going to be around. I mean, you can be around family members who are well-meaning, and I know some of mine and those people I've ran into. I mean, it's not unusual. Well, hey, we're having a Christmas party, or we're having a gathering. Well, here's a six-pack of beer, or here we got a case of wine, or we got a case of champagne.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody's putting it out, and there's almost an expectation that you will imbibe as a part of this. But I made the conscious choice for myself a long time ago that it wasn't worth it.
No.
And yet when you make that conscious choice and, no, I can't do this, it becomes almost, you almost become a social, a cultural pariah because they're going, why don't you want to? I mean.
Oh, yeah, you do. You do it for a social reason, but after about 3 or 4 drinks, you become obnoxious and your jokes aren't so funny anymore. And then first thing you know, you're getting sick and now nobody likes you anymore. But, you know, one of the things they say they do nowadays, especially high schoolers, is they'll take pills and out of the medicine cabinet, they'll take them to a party, put them all in one bowl, everybody brings their own pills, and mix them all together, and then everybody takes a handful of them. And then you drink it on top of that. And so you're totally incapacitated. You will not be able to function pretty soon. And you may die before you come out of that, or brain damage or something. So people take a chance all the time, but I think they get to the point, it's almost like playing Russian roulette. They don't care whether they live or not. They could care less. And so when you believe that, you're really apt to do some very stupid things, really, sometimes. You know, I told you one time, I learned it in Vietnam, but it was people who tend to seem to have the greatest amount of guts have the least amount of brains. And it's kind of a trade-off sometimes. And when somebody does something really dangerous and you see them and they pick up a handful of pills and they say, dare me, dare me. And then somebody says, I'll dare you, and he'll suck them all down. Well, that may be gutsy, and that may be very bold, but that's pretty stupid too, Doug, because once you swallow them, they're down there, and you're going to have to ride this thing out. And, you know, they used to when they had a lot of LSD back in the 60s, and I'm sure it's more today than it was then, but LSD was a popular thing. And once you ate that sugar cube or however you took it, you're going to ride that thing out. Whether you have a good trip or a bad trip, you're going to take it. And people don't understand that sometimes. And it just goes way out of control. We've got so many people now playing with suicide every day of their lives. And a lot of them are succeeding in what they're doing, but I'm not even sure if they want to, Doug. I don't know if they want to live or just quit, you know, and die. But they're doing some really radically crazy things. It may come out in the rest of your life when you get older. Find out you can't have children. Find out you can't do this or you can't do that because of what you did when you were young. And they really need to stop and think about this stuff. These veterans, when they come back, they have a degree of sadness in them. And I think the more combat you've been in, the more sadder or sadness that you carry the rest of your life. And you will constantly always look for things to make you feel better. And I will tell you this. I went through a lot of drugs and alcohol. But, you know, I'm a chaplain, and I know you're a Christian. But when I found Jesus Christ as my Savior, I finally found what happiness really was. And when I got off all that mess I was on, I began to live again. And I know today the VA will give you medications and therapy, which are good in the right amounts. But I had to have peace and forgiveness, and I couldn't get that anywhere else. A lot of things I had done, I carried that guilt for a long time, and I couldn't get rid of it. But when I pleaded my case before God, He somehow said, "I forgive you." And a lot of that guilt came off of me. So there are remedies. Now, people will debate, you know, between this God, that God, religions, and all this stuff. All I can tell you is if your religion's not working in your behalf, then get rid of it and find another one. I do know that Christianity does work, and because there's a whole list of people along the line that have found that. So there is peace, and there is happiness. We just have to find it. And through drugs and alcohol is not the path to do it on.
Well, I think the Christmas season and all this stuff, I mean, we're going into this program be aired on Sunday night just hours before all the travel period starts. So, I mean, we're kind of the last bastion and the last warning.
Right.
We don't know what the weather conditions are going to be. The physiological effects that all the veterans are suffering, we're looking at the epidemiology here right now, and it's staggering as far as neuromuscular problems, as far as, you know, again, what we call the PTSD or the moral injury problems. We got all of their cardiac and the respiratory problems. So the guy is sitting and they're going to get ready. They've worked the full day and now they're going to get in, they're going to load their car up with their family. They're going to load everything and they're going to take on a trip. Well, we don't know what the weather conditions are going to be, or as you said, they're going to be taken out and they're already tired. I know I distinctly remember when we started off for summer vacations when I was a child, my dad worked a full day. And then we drove for 3 hours at night in order to get a start on our vacation to get up northern Minnesota, because it's a two-day drive, you know, and you only got 2 weeks of vacation. So now you got all this coming into play. And then you've got all of the stress and the strain around the holidays, Christmas, this party's got to be perfect, I got to do this, got to act this way, I have to please everybody. Well, sometimes we can't please everybody, and sometimes we can't be everything to everybody.
Well, that's right, and you have to somehow prioritize, and one of the priorities is you've got to keep your head straight. You've got to be sober-minded and sober, because somebody's going to have to run the course. Somebody's going to have to be the, you know, if you want to call it a designated driver or something, you call it what you want to, but if you're on guard duty, and I think all of us are, veterans are, we can't allow ourselves to get off the wall, in a sense. Somebody's going to have to keep their ears open and their eyes open and, you know, have a good time, eat and have, you know, a lot of fun and everything. But if you get incapacitated, a lot of bad things happen. Somebody has to be on guard duty. And I think every one of us are in that position. You know, when the people go, when a lot of veterans go into a restaurant, they always sit with their back against the wall. Why do they do that? To show they're a veteran? Well, cops do the same thing. I know a lot of the officers still that I work with, when they go in a restaurant, they want to do the same thing. They don't like putting their back to a vulnerable situation. They want to know who comes in there. They want to profile them. They're constantly profiling people. If they see a guy with a bulge under his shirt, they want to know what it is. Or if a guy keeps looking at him and making, like, snarly faces or something, he wants to know who that guy is. Because I know officers that have arrested people for 20, 25, 30 years, and they forget some of them, but they get out of prison. And they never know when they're going to walk up against them. A lot of these cops have death threats on them. I know I've been to their houses. They have these little peep windows where they look through. They don't let you in that house. The whole family is on guard, more or less, because they've been threatened, and they know they're very vulnerable. And so it's just something we do. The point I guess I'm trying to make is, Doug, is that we cannot allow ourselves to become victims. We can't give up. We're going to do this the rest of our lives, and we can use it for good just like we could use it for evil. Be on guard duty for your family. Watch out for your friends. Be watching constantly. You know, that's what Homeland Security tells us anyway. And you can't do it if you're going to get drunk. If you're going to get drunk, you're not on the wall. You're really out there getting yourself in a position to get hurt. And so I think it behooves every one of us to make sure that we're conscious of what we're doing. We're conscious of who we're around. If you see people that are unseemly or out of place or something like that, you need to find out why. You need to be observant. And when you're incapacitated, you really can't do anything like that. So it's up to the veterans. And if we get off that wall, if we get to the point that we don't want to live anymore, we're really letting a lot of people down, Doug. I don't mean that in a negative way for the veteran, but I mean it. I can't afford my friends to leave me out here. I don't want to be fighting this battle by myself. And when I'm laying on the ground wounded and hurt and bleeding, I can't fight. I have to depend on my buddies. But when I'm laying down there playing dead, my buddies are having a fight for me, and I'm not helping them out. So I have to get up, get into the battle. I do know post-traumatic stress. We can win this war, but we'll have to do it on our own terms. And we have to be proactive, and we have to find real coping skills. We have to find things that work for us, and we can end up having a good life. But we're going to have to work for it. Because the VA, you know, they're going to give you a number, put you in line, like you were talking about yesterday, and you're going to be going through a lot of stuff, and it's going to be very frustrating. On all the problems you have, now you've been put in a long line, and they may help you or they may not help you. They may pay you or they may not pay you. And if you're depending on that ship coming in, you may die on the beach waiting for it. Because one day I found out ships don't come into the shore. You got to swim out to it once in a while. And so we have to be vigilant, and if the ship gets close, well, swim on out to it. And you just have to always keep your eyes open.
Well, when we look at everything, we know all the medications, and we look at the reports and the medical problems that we have, and the medications that are used to treat this, they're staggering. So they affect your body entirely. We know with the Christmas season that everybody is going to be wanting to drink. I mean, this is just parcel of the culture that we live in, and you have to be able to say no. We're seeing so many, and as you've reported over and over again, the number of young troops that are on sleep medication problems, that are on psychotropic drugs, that are on amphetamines right now. I mean, they're like handing them out like candy. And then, as has been reported, and you've reported right there, the troops are sharing this stuff with each other.
Yeah, they are.
So all this stuff is coming into play, and with the Christmas season, okay, we got to get up in a hurry, we got to travel someplace. Well, I don't really want to go there. Well, the spouse is saying we got to go, or the family is saying we got to go, we got to be there.
Right.
Well, sometimes we just have to say no.
Yeah.
And I think that's extraordinarily difficult, because with the holidays, nobody wants to say no to an invitation. Nobody wants to be the so-called party pooper.
Yeah.
But at a point, or at some point, we have to stem the flow and the problems that are happening.
Yeah, you do. You have to get a grip. You know, our family always spent like $50 to $100 on each person. That's why everybody did that. But we went on for years, and finally, it was me that really put the seed out there. I told my wife, I said, "This is going to end. I'm tired of spending a couple, you know, dropping $2,000 or $3,000 on Christmas. People don't even know what you're buying them, and they don't even like act like they like it. Or you're trying, you're afraid you're if you don't buy something really expensive, they're not going to like it, or they're going to feel bad about it. And I said, look, we got to do something about this thing. Now I said like $20 a piece, and all these girls in our family came up with the idea of $5 a piece. I thought, no, I didn't want to go that far with it, because I'm going to lose a gift on this deal. But, you know, once we did that, everybody was tickled to death. It was like, wow, it's not our birthday anyway. What are we doing? We're crazy. And the ones who have children, you know, they spend it on their children. But you're not spending all this money that you didn't have anyway, Doug. You know, they were talking about last night on the news about people spending all this money they're saving on gasoline, on food, on bills, and credit cards are showing all that stuff. And so they're not spending it on Christmas. They're spending it on their own selves. Most people don't have a lot of money left over, you know, where they always say you have more month than you have money. And Christmas is a time of year that, boy, we really get into this commercialized holiday where we spend thousands of dollars on other people. And then come January, you have trouble making the house payment.
Yeah, that's
and
a frightening.
Just, it's too much. It's just
it's
too much.
Truly.
So you have to take sometimes the lead of this thing, and when I'm saying sober-minded, you might be the only one thinking straight, and say, look, this is not cool. There's a lot of things we can do for each other to show we love each other besides spend all this money that we don't have. And that takes a lot of heat off the family right there, if you know you don't have to do that.
When we were growing up, my parents, they had what was called a Christmas club at the bank. And so you saved all year long, and I've been to that point, I know with our family and our kids, if I don't have the money set aside, totally separate, designated out of the budget, it ain't going to be spent. So in other words, I'm not going to use a credit card and spend the money because I either have the money in my pocket that's excess beyond my bills and my living needs that allow that, and if I don't have it, it doesn't go there. But with the stress of Christmas, everybody is getting into that thing. And as you said, then come January, now they get all the stresses they have from their medical problems already. They've tried to self-medicate and get out of their problems for a few minutes. And it all it did, as you said, is a complicated. And then it comes back around. They're saying, oh, my, how am I going to cover this now? I mean, you know, I didn't plan for this. I don't have it in my budget.
Right. Right.
And so now
it does, and it puts a lot of stress on that family. On the and you know, finances have a big deal to do with a divorce rate. When you lose the, you know, when you start spending a lot of credit cards and everything, and maybe one in the family spending more than the other, and all these things, I'm telling you, it puts a lot of strain on that family. But you can go online, Doug, at some of these websites, and look it up. You know, economic ways or cheap ways to say I love you or something like that. They'll give you all kind of ideas of how to tell people you love them without spending a fortune on them. That, you know, a woman told me one time, Doug, she said, my children don't remember what I gave them, but they do remember what I did with them. And that was the value of that. And sometimes, you know, people at church, sometimes people would give them a note and a card and stuff and say, I love you and Merry Christmas. But on the inside of the card, it would say, I'll give you 4 hours to keep your children on whatever days. And that was a nice gift. That's saying, I'll give you and your husband time to go out and have dinner and do this and that and the other, or I'll do this for you, I'll do that for you. And that is a gift. That is a gift. It's time. It's love, too. And so what it does, it takes pressure off of the family to try to meet this criteria that we all fall into of spending fortunes on people that we don't have it. We just don't have the money to do it.
My wife works
part-time. We had a bakery for 20-some years, and she still does cakes out of our house for the church and different people. But she takes all that money she makes during the year and puts it into a Christmas fund. And during Christmas, she that's what she uses. But not everybody can do that. And I can't imagine the bills that young couples have to spend on child care and all these other things and working and both of them working. And good gracious, I can't imagine how hard it is on them.
One thing that I did, and it's a lot of fun, it goes back to everything. And as you know, I've had fun and my hobby, and it helps me with physical rehabilitation, I started making fleece quilts. I mean,
right.
Go figure, sewing, you know, this guy's a physicist. He's, you know, he's a warrior and he sews. Well, yeah, because in the people I've given him to,
you know,
have just jumped
gun,
into because
you're, right.
you're something you built and made with love and joy.
Yeah.
That you pass on to them where they keep themselves warm and the love, you know, comes on down. So it's one of the reasons I do it. But, I mean, that's where people can do that. And I think today in a culture and society, people have forgot the handy things of just making something and giving it to the other person where it doesn't cost a whole lot, literally out of your budget.
Right.
But the value is greater than anything that you can imagine because it's coming with pure love.
Yeah. I was at a Christmas party the other night, my wife and I. It was a family kind of deal. One of my daughters, her business, had a big Christmas party, and so she invited everybody to the house, and they were cooking steaks and all the stuff. But they were passing gifts out, and the gift that a lady bought me was and it was really a game. So she didn't buy it from me. She just bought it for the game, and I won it, and it was a little birdhouse with a bird in it that you hang keys on. And it was like, what am I going to do with this thing? And then I didn't know she was sitting behind me. And she reached over and she said, I really picked out that special and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, good Lord, this is going to be one of them trade-off gifts, you know. And that's how things go sometimes, Doug. People spend money trying to please people. And the person, like, what in the world did they give me this for? And or, you know, she didn't know I was going to get it anyway, but... that's the way things happen sometimes when you prioritize. And when I say prioritize, your family comes first. You take care of your family, and then if you've got money left over, then you spend it on other people. But don't sacrifice, you know, next month's rent to buy stuff for people that don't need the stuff anyway.
I guess
that's a simple way.
When we look at this, another thing I want to get into in the epidemiology here, and you and I talked about this a little bit.
Yeah.
For my 16th birthday, when I turned 16 back in April of 1965, I got a Yamaha motorcycle.
Yeah.
And I've always had a motorcycle, and as I found out, you also have had a motorcycle most of your life.
Yeah.
But one thing that came out in this new study is the incredible proportions and numbers of motorcycle crash mortality and injuries among Operation Enduring Freedom, Iraqi Freedom, and New Dawn veterans, and the same thing we know from Vietnam vets and Desert Storm. What? I mean, this is staggering, but it's scary. I mean, what's happening here, Ray? Why is it so high? Why are we seeing these incredible problems?
Well, I really believe, because I've experienced it myself, but if you drive around Camp Lejeune, for instance, that's near my home, and it's a combat base, infantry base, you'll find a lot of these young guys on sport bikes, and they're just zipping and zooming up and down the highway, in traffic, out of traffic, the whole deal. Well, if you that's dangerous within itself. But if you put any kind of medications on top of that, Doug, you're raising the odds of your wrecking that motorcycle tremendously. A motorcycle, it will zoom now. That thing will go 180 miles an hour, some of these sport bikes. And I've known guys to ride them like that. One of my buddies was riding one about 160 miles an hour, and he hit a big old seagull or something, hit him, and said the bird exploded all over him. But, you know, it almost knocked him off the motorcycle. But when people add medications to it, and the DOD will tell you, and they've told us recently, now, a lot of the suicides we're seeing today is where some of these young military guys are running the bikes off the road, hit a tree, and they put it down as suicide. Or they'll cross over into the other lane on a two-lane highway, they hit a car head-on. Well, it's suicide. The guy was depressed, the guy was on medication, and therefore he probably offed himself. Well, I tend to believe he probably fell asleep or he got nodded out. Because I've ridden motorcycles a lot, and I know sometimes when you're tired, and I was on medications too, that I had to stop and take a nap on the side of the road because I was so sleepy. Especially in areas where you have a lot of shade, like trees along the highways, when the sun is going through those trees, those leaves and all, it will almost put you to sleep. And it's hard to ride like that. So the other thing, a lot of them were on medications, and they're out there kind of like running for the adrenaline pump, and which is common among veterans, and they just happen to nod off, and bad things happen when you nod off on a motorcycle.
The other thing that's happening here, and when, again, I'm looking at across the epidemiology, as you and I discussed, we're seeing incredible numbers where they have the neuromuscular fine motor control problems.
Yeah.
Well, as we all know, and I've been riding a motorcycle, I mean, let's see, well, 66, man, that's
right.
50 years, okay?
Yeah.
You have to have complete total hand, foot coordination at all times. You can't have a deficiency from right to left or from right foot to left foot or left hand to right foot. You have to be at 100% there. Well, when we look at the diagnosis and the medical problems with the incredible numbers of these young kids and all of us that have neuromuscular or spinal cord injuries or deficiencies, that's a death notice on a motorcycle.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's just asking to die. And I mean, what I had to do, and it's been the roughest thing about it, I literally had to disconnect the gas tank, drain the gas tank, and disconnect it completely so there was no way that I could get the anxious and go out there and fire that thing up and go riding.
That's smart. I can't do it anymore. You take away the temptation to do it sometimes. But, you know, the DOD told us last year, actually, they said they thought they were losing 100 a day in the active duty and reserve to suicide. But what they're doing is they're considering the fact that it's not really, they're not considered, but we are, that it may not be suicide as much as it is where people are on medications or they've been drinking or something, and they're out there on motorcycles and they just happen to have a bad day. They fall asleep, they hit a tree, they do something like that. So it's just one of those things that the DOD thinks of it as suicide because the guy was depressed and he was on medications. But it could have been the medications causing the problem.
Yeah, so we're looking at a problem. I guess the whole Christmas season, I mean, again, I wanted to put this together and I'm glad you joined, is the warning is you got to watch your medications, you got to watch your rest, you got to watch your expenditures, you got to watch the food you eat, you got to watch the activity you're involved in. You got to make good choices. As you've said over and over again, your choice depends on who you hang around with and who you party with. They can mean totally well, but the holiday and the Christmas season is almost like, well, you got to drink, or you got to do this, or you got to go here.
You just have to keep your head together. You know, you joined the military, and when the military got in you, I don't think it will ever leave us, Doug. I know it hasn't you, and it hasn't me. And so we're going to be on guard duty the rest of our lives until we leave out of this place of some way, somehow, stepping up. Nobody else going to do it. These people that I live around, they've never been anything like that. They live in a whole, like a soft world where they have guns, but they go to shooting range once in a while. But they've never been in life-threatening situations, and I don't know how they're going to react. And if they're all out there and they're drinking and they're doing this and doing the other thing, I can't rely on them, Doug. I have to keep my head straight for me and for my family and for anybody else out there. I saw that cop on TV talking out in San Bernardino, I think it was. He hollered, "I'll take a bullet for you." How many people, Doug, do you know that would actually take a bullet for you? And if a guy's had three or four drinks, he's not going to take a bullet for you, probably. He will probably be thinking about himself or something. And so we just have to be sober-minded. We have to keep our heads straight. And don't give up. Please don't give up. Because there's no hope if we all give up out there.
I was sitting there in the waiting room at the VA yesterday, and the lady was in there working, and she said, "You know, I'm totally frustrated because they make every roadblock in here to want me to quit and go away."
Right.
And I saw there was a Vietnam vet also that I ran into yesterday, and he had a Purple Heart. It was messed up from Agent Orange, still trying to get his care. And he said, "Well, I thought when we got a Purple Heart and we're trashed that we're going to get to the priority in the front of the list to get my medical care."
Right.
It ain't going to happen. There ain't no Christmas presents.
No, no. You know, Doug, I wrote a story in my book. It's called In the Coping Skills Part. But it was about the Civil War where a general, his side was being beat real bad. So he wrote up to a teenage bugler, a 14-year-old boy, never been in combat, and he told him to sound retreat. We had to pull back. And the boy said he couldn't do it. And the general was stunned. He ran over and grabbed him and shook him and slapped him. And he said, I said, sign a retreat, boy. My men are dying. And the boy said, sir, I can't do it. And he said, why can't you do it? And he said, I was never taught how. So the general said, well, do something, boy. We're losing this fight. And so the general rode off. And the young boy stood there for a minute. And he only had been there about a month. And the only song he'd ever learned was Charge. And so in the midst of a retreat, he started playing Charge over and over and over and over because the only song he knew. Well, the men on the front lines heard him, and they thought reinforcements had arrived, so they began fighting like wild men. The men who were laying out on the field wounded heard him. They thought reinforcements had arrived, so those who could got back up and rejoined the battle. Those who were hiding out in the woods afraid to die heard him, and they thought reinforcements had arrived, so they became more afraid of being caught by their own men running. So they returned to the battle, and the battle turned that day, and they won. It's because that boy had never learned the song of retreat. And none of us have ever been taught how to retreat. All we ever taught us was how to face our enemy and go after him. And, Doug, I think that's what we're called on to do today, is identify the enemy and go and get him and stop him before he stops everybody else. And I think every veteran has been called to do that. We can't give up on this thing. We're going to be losing this deal. And I said in that article that every time one of our veterans commits suicide, I'm sure the enemy, ISIS and Al-Qaeda and everybody else, is laughing because they're thinking, that's one more we didn't have to kill. And he's gone. I won't have to worry about him anymore. And you're almost helping them out when you do such a thing. So I hope these veterans, and I hope other people who are dealing with trauma and post-trauma, will consider things more so and not give up this holiday season. It's a time to worship God and thank him for what he's done. It's not a time to be depressed and tore all to pieces and kill yourself and hurt other people. And I just hope they consider before they do anything.
Well, thank you very much, Ray. I mean, God bless. I think you kind of summed it all up. Ladies and gentlemen, preventive medicine. That's what it's about. We lead for the future, and we go on. Ray, thank you very much, and God bless you, and we'll talk to you later on.
You too, Doug. Thank you.
Okay, goodbye.
Bye.